Okay, welcome everyone. This is a panel I've been looking forward to for a long time. I never worked with Glenn before, so this is the first time I'm speaking to him in person, and I've never met Dr. Rao before, so aside from email, this is the first time I've ever met him. So nice to meet both of you.
Good to meet you, Steve.
Good to meet you too, Steve.
And Dr. Oppenlander, for those of you that don't know, has spoken at our conferences several times. He took off a bunch of years over the past few years to take care of his son, who passed away at 37 from brain cancer. So this is the first year he's been back. Dr. Oppenlander, before we get started, do you want to take a moment, tell everyone who your son Ty was and why he was such an important person in the world for all the people that never got a chance to know him?
Well, thank you, Stephen. I appreciate that. Ty was an inspiration to a number of people. He led a life similar to what you just saw in Dr. Rao's prelude there, where he was selfless and helped people and was just a bright light in everybody's life, and did a number of things for those around him to bring happiness and joy. And he with his two sisters they grew up without eating animal products, and so they were basically role models for those around them at a time when it was, this is like 30 years ago. And I do want to point out that he had I won't go into a lot of detail, but he had the most aggressive type of brain tumor in the worst possible area in the pons area, and that typically affected, and I think this is important for some of your viewers to hear, but it typically affects 7 to 10 year olds. It's a type of an adult DIPG, a diffuse intrinsic pontine glioma. And I think what kind of resounds for me is that we really tried to attack this in the most unconventional way, because convention didn't work over the last 40 years that he was given 6 months to live. And so he lived 3 years, but it still was, 3.5 years, and it was still real from his diagnosis, and it was still real difficult. But that's another area that I've been working to try to improve, because it's another one of these things that Stephen, you and I can talk about another time, but conventional treatment absolutely, does not work and sets people in the wrong direction, just like it does for a number of other cancers. But one thing that is important is that the top researchers in the world couldn't really answer why he lived. They thought he had this tumor at 7 to 11 years old. And they couldn't really answer why he lived a very healthy life. He was one of the top in his class academically, athletically, spiritually, and but he lived probably another 20, 25 years before it was actually diagnosed. And I am under the firm belief that, this is without, this is anecdotally, but I'm under the firm belief that it was because of his diet. It's sort of suppressed. He's eating basically an anti-angiogenic diet, with anti-cancer and anti-inflammatory and no animal products. So anyway, I'm back. Thanks to Stephen and encouraging me. I know the plant needs some help, and I'm here to help in whatever way I can.
Thank you, Dr. Oppenlander. It's good to have you back.
Thank you.
Okay, so why don't you each give just an opening quick statement of what your name is, what you've been doing the last 20 years, your latest book, just so everyone can hear from you just very briefly before I start questions. You could go in the order of Dr. Rao, Dr. Oppenlander, and then Glenn. That would be good.
Thank you, Stephen. My name is Sailesh Rao. I'm an engineer by profession, and I used to work on the internet, as you heard in the introduction. Then in 2005, I happened to see Al Gore's presentation on TV, and I was so shocked. I said, if half of what he's saying is true, I'm wasting my time. So I decided to look into it, and I realized it's actually far worse than what he's saying. So I closed my company, and I focused on the environment full time since 2006. I got trained by Al Gore. I worked with him for a few years. I tried to convince him to start addressing animal agriculture, and I failed to do that. And so then I basically said, I have to work on this on my own. And so this is when, I mean, I started Climate Healers in 2007. And the idea was to heal the climate, and to heal the climate from a very holistic perspective. It is, how do you reverse the heating that's happening today? And that requires us to basically transform from a climate heating species to a climate healing species, because we are very well organized for heating the climate at the moment. We're doing a really good job of it, as everyone will tell you. But we can organize ourselves to heal the climate, because once we recognize that we have the power to change the climate, we have the power to heal it as well. So, but it requires a different kind of organization, requires a different kind of axiom in the civilization, so to speak. So I really say that we are in a double Galilean moment in human history, where we have to overturn two false axioms. You know, during Galileo's time, they had to overcome the idea that the sun goes around the earth and switch it to the earth going around the sun in order to really start the scientific revolution. In the same way, we have to overcome the axiom of consumerism and the axiom of supremacism in order to start the sustainability revolution. And we are on our way to doing that, which is exactly what the vegan movement is all about as well. So I'm glad to be here, and thank you so much for this opportunity, Stephen.
Thank you.
My name is Richard Openlander, and I couldn't agree with Dr. Rao more. To consolidate, you know, thoughts about my journey, basically, I realized maybe 45, 50 years ago is when I was in graduate school, I started looking a little closer at what our dietary choices affected our own human health. And then went from there, like many people have a journey that will bring them eventually to how our dietary choices, how they come about in terms of agricultural systems. And then I started seeing exactly what was going on behind the scenes. And so this has been an evolution that began maybe 45 years ago. And then I started speaking, started bringing all three together in terms of how animals are, what we're doing to the animals, but not just domesticated. I'm talking about wild animals as well, displacement. And exploitation. So basically, I decided maybe 20, 25 years ago to bring it all full circle and try to educate. That's why the title of my first book was Comfortably Unaware, because I was under the belief that the world just needed to be educated. Now I know there's a number of other forces at play, but I committed myself to at different points in my life to educating, and then to to effectively move the critical mass forward through those with platforms of influence as well as the public, and to bring it to understand not just climate change, but understand, in fact, you know, there are different drivers of the damage we're doing to our planet. And so and we can talk more about that as the panel begins. And I talk quite a bit about that in the presentation I had on Saturday as well as on Tuesday. And so I try to bring all factors together about the tipping points that we have, which ones we've surpassed, and how we can change this by way of diet.
Thank you.
My name is Glenn Mercer. My background is as a writer. Started as a playwright, and then somehow I found myself in Los Angeles writing TV shows for 10 years. Very forgettable sitcoms and so forth. And the year that they stopped hiring me for some reason in LA, 96, I met Howard Lyman, who was a cattle rancher turned vegan animal rights activist. We decided to try to write a book together. So that was my first effort at writing nonfiction. And we wrote the book Mad Cowboy. And until I had that opportunity to write Mad Cowboy, I had been what I call a shy vegan, by which I mean I was doing it for my own health. I believed it's the healthiest diet. I wasn't then as informed about how to create a truly healthy diet as I am now. So I used to eat a lot of, you know, vegan processed food. As I did research for Howard, I began to feel that it's not enough to be a shy vegan, and you have to speak about it and help other people learn to switch to the plant-based diet. And so since that, writing that book with Howard, Mad Cowboy, we did a second book called No More Bull. And then I co-authored a number of other books in this space. And in the last 2 years, I've written two books of my own. One is called Own Your Health, which is a book on nutrition. I set for myself a very low bar, which was that I wanted to try to write the funniest book ever written on nutrition. Now, if you think about it, there are some great books on nutrition, like The China Study by T. Colin Campbell, or Prevent and Reverse Heart Disease by Dr. Caldwell Esselstyn. These are great books, but they're not remotely funny. So I wanted to try to write a book on nutrition that would be funny and easy to read. So that's Own Your Health. And then I heard about a fellow named Dr. Silas Rao, who had written a paper asserting that animal agriculture was responsible for at least 87% of greenhouse gases. And I had heard of the FAO's 18%, which they later changed to 14.5%. And I had heard of Goodlin and Anhang's World Watch paper, 51%. I'd never heard 87% before. So I contacted Silas and asked him what he based it on, and we got to know each other. And I believe that not only is he right, but that, as he will tell you, he left out other factors that it could easily be. He frames it as at least 87%. And there are other factors that are impossible to measure, like the industrial fishing that dredges up soil from the bottom of the ocean, and how much is that hurting? We don't have any measurements on that. We don't have any measurements on pasture maintenance fires around the world and so forth. So it may well be that over 90% of greenhouse gases is caused by animal agriculture. And that's just a story that I felt needed to be told. So that's my last book, Food is Climate.
Thank you. So before I get started, I want to ask you a question. Is it possible that we're just wasting your time and our audience's time and everyone's time, and the whole conference is a waste of time? Because it doesn't matter. Well, let me, the argument being that, does it really matter if we point all this stuff out when, in the end of the day, industries, let's take the oil industry or the beef industry or the dairy industry or the chemical industry, they make a lot of money, they have a lot of investors, they have a lot of employees, they have ad agencies, they have PR agencies, they give a lot of money to the media. And if you say that you've got to take the people who are investing in oil or in coal or in chemicals or in animal agriculture are going to lose a lot of money because this industry is going to go away, then those people, the investors, the employees, the board of directors, all the people who benefit from that industry are going to fight and fight and fight and not want to give up and not want to change. So even if we prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that it's urgent and it's necessary to make these changes, the companies that would have to change would have to, them and their investors would lose money and very likely would say, I don't want to make the change because I don't want to lose my investment. So for that reason, should we even have this panel or this conference? Does it even make a difference? Or are those companies, no matter what you prove, going to say, no, we don't believe it, we don't accept it, because I don't want to lose my investment in this industry?
Well, I have a short answer. Do you want me to help with that? With a short
Please,
answer,
all
brief answer?
Yes.
Yeah. First of all, and there's two parts to this. One is that we, those that understand this and then have a platform of awareness that we do, I think it's our duty. It's our responsibility. We're the last of the generations or combination of generations that actually can make a difference for future generations, a proper difference, and turn things around. So on one, the short answer is it's our duty to do this. We have to do it. We have to bring as much awareness as possible, and we have to have solutions. That brings me to the second point, which is there are very viable solutions to this that Silas and Glenn can talk about specifically with climate change if they'd like, but it also traverses through all aspects of the web of what I call global depletion. There are ways, and I'm going to be talking about this more tomorrow night. I'll have very specific jobs that can be created. And there are a number of organizations now that know this. They're writing about it. World Economic Forum just came out last year with they're very respected, with a projected a much larger, like $10 trillion by the year 2030, just placed in nature-based solutions. But they had three categories. One was infrastructure, one was energy, but one was food and involving our land use and ocean systems. And that alone, according to them, I believe, and I'll talk more about it tomorrow, that it's higher than this, the numbers are higher than this, but they have made a very convincing argument that we can generate $3.6 trillion just in the next 7 years globally and add 191 million jobs. And that doesn't even include transitioning the $770 billion that we spend globally in subsidies. So there is a way, Stephen, in terms of the audience, to convince policymakers and industry that they will not lose jobs. We can actually add jobs while saving the planet. It just has to be done systematically, and it has to be done not only with public awareness, but it has to be done with what I would call more educating the educated and those with a platform of influence. So I hope that helps a little bit, kind of open the door for Dr. Rao and Glenn to fill in the blanks.
Well, I'll say this, that Steve, the premise of your question is, is that this is David versus Goliath, that there's such a strong, powerful economic forces, that what chances do we have? First of all, the good news is David has a good track record versus Goliath. But second of all, I tend to feel that way when I think about fossil fuels. I think, man, how do we get the oil companies to stop drilling for oil and creating all this carbon in the atmosphere? But the good news is that as tough as it is to deal with the direct emissions that come from the fossil fuel industry, that's counterbalanced by the fact that, in a sense, it's easy to deal with the side of the equation that I think the three of us all focus on, which is animal agriculture. All of us have to do is stop eating meat, and the industry has no power over us. All we have to do is have a grassroots effort and get the world to stop eating meat. Now, obviously, that's highly difficult. The odds are David versus Goliath odds, but it's entirely in our hands. It's not in the hands of the oil companies or some giant corporations. It's entirely a grassroots thing where it's all the power is with the people. If all the people in the United States tomorrow stopped eating meat, there'd be nothing that Cargill could do about it. So all the power is in our hands on the animal agriculture side of it. On the fossil fuel side, it's tougher in my opinion. But on the animal agriculture side, all the power is in our hands, and that's 87% or more of the problem. So we really can defeat this just with our diet.
Yeah, I have a more systemic view of this. When I was finishing my bachelor's, actually, I worked on a problem that had to do with nonlinear phase transitions. how nonlinear phase transitions happen. And it had to do with circuits, you know, when I was doing my work, but it is very similar to any nonlinear phase transition that happens in human society. And to me, history is a chronicle of all the nonlinear phase transitions that happened in human history. Yeah, because we don't chronicle things that were the same. We chronicle things that made a big change, big difference. And so history is full of nonlinear phase transitions. And yet at any given point in time, we assume that whatever is happening will continue happening forever. Even though if we draw the lines and you say, if I continue drilling for oil and burning oil forever, if I continue eating animals forever, and you see that you're going to be dead. You know you're going over a cliff. So at that point, you know, there are forces that come into play that cause nonlinear phase transitions to happen. It's like what happened with Galileo, right? So it was a nonlinear phase transition. You know, once we all agreed that the Earth goes around the sun and not the other way around, no one could come back and tell us, you know, let's go back to the way things were. You know, and then Newton's laws of motion came into play, and people, you know, science became a powerful way of discovering the truth. And so all that scientific revolution could not have happened without overturning that assumption. In the same way, we are going through nonlinear phase transition right now. We are in the middle of it. And yet people do linear extrapolation. They think that whatever is happening now will continue happening forever. And these corporations are going to destroy the whole planet and there's nothing we can do about it. Well, that's a linear extrapolation. I mean, things do change in a very nonlinear way. So that's my systemic explanation for what is going to happen. This is why I call it a phase transition, a metamorphosis that's happening. And we are shifting from a caterpillar phase to a butterfly phase. So we are in the cocoon of the caterpillar right now. We are in the chrysalis phase. And COVID-19 actually put us in the chrysalis phase. It's really like a signal from Mother Nature saying, go to your room and think about what you're doing. You know, that is the chrysalis. And so we are in that process of transformation.